You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 82 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carzino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It's the Daryl Jackson edition of the podcast.
Oh, not the Daryl Jackson edition. It's the Happy Birthday King Griffey Jr. edition.
Yeah, celebrating a 48th birthday today, which is a fact that I knew off the top of my head when you mentioned this before the pod.
Yes.
That's kind of disturbing.
That's what you're about.
I am not 100% sure. I don't know how many family members' birthdays I can actually correctly identify.
Did you know the day? You knew the year. Did you know? Well, I guess you knew the day because it was today.
What, I don't know if I could have. If you asked me what's Ken Griffey's birthday, I'm not sure I would have known. It's November 21st. But once I knew it was November 21st, I knew it was 1969.
It's very strange.
Indeed. We have a lot to get to. So let's get started. Starting with the beer we're drinking this week, courtesy our friends at Pyramid Brewing.
Which was sent to us by our friends at Pyramid Brewing Company. They would like us to review this beer, talk about this beer on the podcast. It is a Pyramid Blazer Mania IPA.
It is. So annually, the Pyramid does a Blazers beer. I think this is 3 or 4 years now that they've done it. I don't think we ever came across last year's beer, which was a tribute to their longtime broadcaster, Bill Shonley. But I know for sure a couple years ago, we definitely had it. And we actually cracked into this last Saturday when we were tailgating before the UW-Utah game. And it was awfully good. So a little bit about this, the hops in here. Well, first the description. Great players come and go, but the best fans in the NBA will always be here. From our brewery in Northwest Portland, we celebrate you, the Blazers fans. Cheers to Portland and go Blazers.
And also the Belton guest, Seattle.
Well, we're sort of Blazers fans at the moment here in Seattle. The hops in here in this IPA, Nugget, Centennial, Amarillo, and Calypso.
You could taste the Calypso.
We had Calypso last week, right?
Oh, did we?
That was in the IPA we had last
week. I'll tell you, you can really taste the Calypso.
It's good. It's a good amount of Calypso. So.
Also weird that the Blazer beer would have Nuggets hops in it.
I didn't think about that. Wow. Wow. Before we drink this, it's already too late for you. A toast in order to the Seattle Sounders, I think. Oh. We'll talk about them later in the show. But a 2-0 win in the first leg of the Western Conference Championship against Colorado. Really impressive performance to them. And then also, I guess, to the Blazers winning last night against the Grizzlies.
Nice.
Not as exciting a performance, not as meaningful, but still a good win on the road for them. So,
I thought we were toasting to something else, though.
What did you think we were toasting?
I thought we were toasting to a new listener.
Well, not necessarily a new listener, apparently. So last week, I made my triumphant return to the Basketball Friends Mailbag podcast, and we discussed the Pelton cast a little bit, and here's what came up.
I bet you're huge in Finland.
Yeah, I haven't heard from any Finns yet. Hit me up if you're Finnish and listen not only to the Pelton cast, but also to the Basketball Friends.
So lo and behold, later that day, after the podcast comes out, I get a tweet from a listener saying, "What's up with Finns?" And I'm like, "Are you a listener to Finns?"
Yeah.
Are you a listener to the Pelton cast? And it turns out that they are a listener to the Pelton cast. So shout out. And, you know, we're thankful this Thanksgiving for all of our listener, but particularly for our Finnish listener, Juuso Seinio. Shout out to you, good sir, for following along with Seattle sports and Seattle food somewhat inexplicably from a continent away, an ocean away.
What a great way to celebrate Thanksgiving, by celebrating somebody who does not even celebrate the holiday.
That is true. That is very appropriate.
I'd use the word celebrate way too many times. Did you mention earlier, I wanted to have a giveaway in the spirit of Thanksgiving.
You did want to do that.
And you didn't do that on Twitter.
I have not done it yet.
Okay. Okay.
So earlier today, we released our Pelton Cast Thanksgiving food special with special guest third Pelton brother, Nate Duncan. Back by popular demand, I would say, to talk about food. People love his food.
It was great.
It was. So we listed off our top five Thanksgiving food items, and we want to hear your top five Thanksgiving food items. So leave those on Twitter with the hashtag PeltonCast top five, and we will randomly select one of the people who responds with their top five Thanksgiving food items to win a PeltonCast hat.
Wow.
It was very exciting, by the way. Last week, we were able to deliver the hat in person to loyal listener Nate as we tailgated before the UW-Utah game.
You pretty much, it's now a rule that if you get a hat, you have to take a photo with us. Or at least if you don't live in the Seattle area, you have to Photoshop yourself into a photo of us wearing that.
There you go. I like that thinking.
But so that podcast with Nate, excellent as always, right?
Of course.
Nate Duncan's the real Tour de Force.
Yes.
I'm walking around the convention center and I'm like, I need to be a little bit quiet because there are a lot of people around. And then I just get so excited about Thanksgiving. Like, there are people that were sitting in various areas trying to work and they just got up and left. I'm clearing rooms out with this podcast.
That's outstanding. That's great work. Also, you purchased sweet potato pie after the podcast to eat tonight.
Oh, there's vanilla bean ice cream also. We're doing that.
I can't believe that there were people who questioned the ice cream with the sweet potato pie. That came as a shock to me.
I really like the you did a poll yesterday. These are just random thoughts now. you did a poll yesterday about what kind of podcast we should do post Falcons game. And it was, should we do something that was going to be a recap of the Falcons game, a normal weekly podcast, or some of both, or neither? And I like neither being a resounding favorite.
Well, no, you know, actually, neither barely ended up. It currently, as we record this, there have been 46 votes, and it's 31% for neither, 30% for regular weekly pod. But you know,
I like, we just didn't record it. It was like, we got to give the people what they want. Yeah, and that's nothing.
Exactly. Got to give the people what they want.
You should have had a fifth option, which was never record another podcast.
Some people might have been into that. Should we get into the regular weekly pod?
So go listen to the Thanksgiving food pod. Tweet at us. Send an email. However you want to communicate. And send us your Thanksgiving food top five on Thanksgiving today. When you and I are together at the kids' table on Thanksgiving, we will choose a winner for a Peltoncast at.
We will do that. Also, keep sending in those dumpling recommendations for a dumpling bracket. We got many good suggestions last week.
And stop recommending Dozone. We're aware of Dozone.
This new place called Din Tai Fung. That wasn't with a person from Seattle, but it that actually came up last week. That happened. Should we start by talking about the Seattle Arena situation?
Yeah, a lot has happened, and I have no idea what it is. I actually need you to explain this to me. What's going on?
All right, so last week was the final meeting of the Seattle City Council Select Committee on Civic Arenas, and hopefully that's the last time I ever have to say that name because it's way too many words. As part of that meeting, they discussed amendments that wouldn't actually necessarily be automatically put into the Memorandum of Understanding with Oakview Group to renovate Key Arena, but were suggestions basically to be negotiated with them by the executive mayoral staff. Not really anything of note, I think, in the amendments. One we talked about last week that would have prohibited using the transportation funding provided by Oakview towards monorail upgrades, that ended up being withdrawn. So nothing that really substantially changed the agreement. And then at the end of this council meeting, the five remaining council members who were there voted 5-0 to pass the Memorandum of Understanding on to the full council for a vote, which is scheduled to be held on December 4th, the day after the Memorandum of Understanding with Chris Hansen's group expires.
Interesting. Okay.
So based on the fact that it was a 5-0 vote, based on the commentary, based on everything that happened, there's really no reason, I think, at this point to believe that the MOU will not pass city council.
Yes.
So at that point, it will be new mayor Jenny Durkin to sign the MOU into effect. There's an ordinance that you can read on the RFP website that's been kind of the home for this, which notably, there had been some discussion about whether the council would exempt the deal from I-91, the initiative passed by Seattle voters while the Sonics were looking for a new arena before they moved, that requires investments in sports facilities to return a yield similar to that of a long-term treasury bond. And the justification for that, they believe, as we've noted in the past, that this deal does conform to the spirit of I-91. They want to specifically exempt it under the grounds that Oakview Group is not a professional sports organization.
Okay. What does that mean?
It seems like a somewhat flimsy argument, given that Oakview Group is building a professional sports arena. Yeah. But I guess they could argue it's just a music arena at this point, since there are no sports tenants. Anyways, I think the one thing left to watch here, really, since this, it feels like a done deal. Also, earlier this week, there was an announcement that the city of Seattle and the Seattle school district, Seattle Public Schools, plan to renovate Memorial Stadium and build a, they're going to build a high school on that site as well as a new stadium.
Really?
And
Center yeah, School isn't enough?
It is not big enough, sadly. Shouts to David Sykes. So they, it was mentioned in that press conference by Tim Burgess, I think this was, by Acting Mayor Tim Burgess, that it will be, you know, basically situated alongside the new Seattle, a new Key Arena.
Oh, okay.
So like it's being taken for granted at this point.
Yes.
This is going to go through. I think the one thing that I, like I said, to watch here is whether there ends up being any movement on one specific provision in this MOU.
Okay.
And that's the one about exclusivity. So the clause reads, the city shall not provide financial support, benefits, or incentives other than those that are generally available to any potential developer with respect to the construction of any live entertainment venue with a capacity of more than 15,000 seats within the jurisdictional boundaries of the city of Seattle. So obviously that would apply to potentially the two arena solution that the Soto group led by Chris Hansen
and
has
there's
discussed.
No way that Hansen would build an arena with 14,999 seats.
It wouldn't make sense as an NBA arena at this that size unless there's a change in kind of the philosophy about NBA arenas.
Okay.
And based on, I don't think the Chargers have been so successful at the Home Depot Center in their small stadium that we're likely to see that change in other pro sports. Now, what's unclear is whether this would prevent them from even approving the street vacation that the Soto group needs to build the arena is intended, because that, I think, would potentially be something that would be available to any developer.
Okay.
But it certainly would prevent them from getting the admissions tax waiver that they seek to have as part of their plan. That's kind of the one, you know, specific government subsidy they plan to seek as part of their privately financed plan.
And so you think if there is movement on that specific exclusivity clause, that it leaves the window open for the two states agreement solution?
I mean, it prevents it from being shut at the very least. Now, it's interesting. So like I said, Durkin will be the mayor who signs this into action because she takes office next week. And she has been very clear that she doesn't support either side in particular. She's very neutral in this. So I can see her, because of that, potentially being opposed to this exclusivity clause.
Okay.
That's no, I have no information on that. That's just kind of a reading of the tea leaves kind of thought. So that's, I think, the one thing left to watch since this vote will almost certainly pass on December 4th.
What about the conversation around, I guess there are two things, about potentially bringing in an NBA owner sooner and around the arena being much more profitable with an NBA team?
Yeah, I mean, so that was in, we discussed last week, the report from the central staff to the city council members leading into that committee meeting. And I mean, it squares with everything that Oakview has said. It's interesting because, you know, we've talked in this process about the example of Kansas City and the Sprint Center, where they were not able to attract an NBA or NHL tenant. And Tim Leiwicki, who built Sprint Center when he was running AEG at that point and promised to bring one of those teams when it was built, you know, explained that it was an issue with the lack of local, you know, lack of significant investment from local ownership to buy a team, and then also the size of those markets in terms of bringing in a team. But the other thing that happened is along the way, you know, once Sprint Center had been opened and had been serving as a music venue, had also been playing host to, they host like the Big 12 tournament on a regular basis, things like that. They explained that because of the quality of those dates, if you were to bring in a team, the arena would make less money because those are not as profitable. The team is not as profitable,
yes,
as the concerts and as the other events they're able to bring to town. Why that's not the case in Seattle is unclear to me. Now, maybe it is a market size issue because tickets would be more expensive in Seattle. You'd have more ancillary revenue from broadcasting and things like that that would make it more palatable for a team to come here without the same kind of revenue from the arena. But that's still one that I don't feel like I've gotten a satisfactory answer on.
It's going to be just the kind of landmark that put places like Brockway, Ogdenville, and North Haverbrook on the map. But has there been any any news or movement on the NBA side?
Well,
rumblings?
First, I do want to circle back to one other thing, going back to that issue in terms of the exclusivity clause, which there was an interesting news story last week that Elvis Presley Enterprises, which runs Graceland, is suing the city of Memphis over a similar clause related to the construction of FedEx Forum. And they, it's much, much stronger. It's any venue, I believe, larger than 6,000 seats, but it might be 5,000. And they want to build a 6,200-seat entertainment multipurpose venue at Graceland and are unable to do it using public financing, any public investment, for the same reason as this clause would prevent.
I mean... It's just so insane to me, the gall of people who are getting public money, that they're not only getting public money, but as part of the agreement, they're saying that nobody else can have public money.
Which is especially odd in this case because, you know, obviously the Soto Arena Group is not asking for almost any public money. It's a much more limited investment than would go into the public part of, you know, what's going back to Oakview Group.
I mean, I understand exclusivity clauses naturally, but like, just being like, nobody else can have this doesn't really make any sense to me.
Yep.
I mean, a lot more so in Memphis than it does here, because especially with the size.
Yeah. So on ownership, an interesting note. So Bill Simmons last week on The Ringer had his winners of the first month of the NBA season. And one of the winners of the first month of the NBA season was the Seattle Supersonics.
Really?
Who have not technically speaking played a game.
I mean, I feel pretty good about the Thunder not playing well.
And all he said in explanation of that was shh.
Interesting.
So I don't know what he knows, but that's interesting to
there
hear.
There are whispers, though. We can project that out and say that there are whispers happening around the league.
I mean, we talked in the past about how, you know, some of the reporting that was done at ESPN by my colleagues Zach Lowe and Brian Windhorst suggested that some of the small market franchises in the league, including the Grizzlies, who have their own ownership drama right now, were not as profitable as you would imagine given the influx of money from the new TV deal and the growth in the salary cap. So it does seem more plausible at this point that a team could be on the move in the near future than it seemed 3 or 4 months ago.
Okay. What about with hockey? I know that there was a rumor about a team moving to Houston or expanding to Houston.
There was a report in The Athletic last week about that, and the new Rockets owner, Tillman Fertitta, who recently bought the team, pretty quickly shot that down, saying he'd had no talks with the NHL about bringing a team there and didn't plan to do so himself.
Okay. So it just kind of appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, and was used, you know, I saw there was a piece on Sonics Rising that's an argument for why Seattle needs to move quickly to secure an NHL franchise, which, you know, if the Key Arena renovation is approved, the anticipation is shortly thereafter would follow the announcement of an expansion franchise for Seattle.
Okay.
But I don't think Houston is the competitor for that the story made it seem.
Okay.
All right, so that's it on the arena front. We'll stay tuned there. As I noted, next week, Jenny Durkin will take office as mayor, and you know, maybe we'll start to learn a little bit more about, you know, what her thinking is as she takes that position. All right, staying on basketball front, Husky men's
just hoops. Barely.
Yeah, Husky men's hoop last week visited Madison Square Garden, where they are now 0-4 in modern history. I don't know when the last time was they played at the Garden before that, but they have twice played in the 2K Classic and have gone winless in both of those appearances. This wasn't all bad in terms of the trip. They really hung with Providence, Providence on Thursday night, losing 77-70 in that game, which was competitive right up until the final minutes, despite the fact that Providence is a pretty highly ranked team that went on to blow out St. Louis by 27 points in the championship game of the 2K Classic. We had all prepped all week on the podcast for the Huskies facing St. Louis in the second game.
They managed to face the two best teams in the tournament.
They did. So Virginia Tech got upset by St. Louis and took that out against the Huskies, beating them 103-79 in the consolation game early Friday, a game that was marked by the Hokies shooting 15 of 22 from three-point range.
Oh, God.
So the Huskies now allowing on the season 44.6% shooting from three-point range, which is at the time I looked this up ranked 330th in the country. We've talked about this before. Teams do not have much control over what percentage opponents shoot from three-point range, particularly over only a handful of games. Even over a full season, they have limited control, if any. This is going to regress to the mean.
I mean, it'll probably regress to the mean. You said that they don't have control over how well teams shoot, but they do have control over how many threes opponents shoot.
Yeah, and that's...
This zone is leaving people wide open for three. And they're taking them.
I mean, this wasn't, there weren't actually that many attempts in the two games they played at MSG. I mean, Virginia Tech only attempted 22. That's really not actually that many at this point, you know, for a college basketball game. The ratio of three attempts is still much too high. It ranks 282nd in the country by the Huskies, with more teams having played and regressed to the mean, now down to 335th.
There we go.
The 3-point percentage allowed. They're 282nd in three-point attempts per field goal attempt, which is not good, but is better than it was previously.
These numbers are way too high for me to feel positive about them. These are your argument and things are okay numbers.
I mean, Providence, let's see.
282nd.
15 threes. Like, the two lowest games in terms of total number of three attempts came the last two games. More troubling to me is the fact that Husky opponents are shooting 55% on two-point attempts, and the zone has proved weak there.
It's weak everywhere.
And I have a theory.
Okay.
So Providence really struggled with the zone in the first half. I don't think they see it very often. Marquette, or Virginia Tech, by contrast, Buzz Williams had been at Marquette previously, which was in the Big East. They played Syracuse twice a year, or at least once a year. He knows the zone inside and out. So I think we saw Providence figure it out in the second half when they shot, and for a while there, they were shooting like 80% from the field in the second half, which was not great. Syracuse kind of already had it unlocked, Virginia Tech, rather. So I think teams that are experienced against the zone are going to have a lot of success against the Huskies because they're just not playing it at that Syracuse level yet. They're not as used to it. But teams that are unfamiliar with it may have a tough time, particularly early in games.
The only positive that, I mean, they actually played well against Providence.
Yeah.
All things considered, the Huskies have played pretty well in three out of their four games.
Yeah. Virginia Tech is really the only time that it's been kind of like what we expected a lot against competitive teams this season.
But even with that said, the only positive that I've been able to take away from that trip is that because they're nowhere near the people shooting with this zone, it feels like they haven't had as many terrible fouls called against them or those series. Do you remember this was 2 years ago, I think, where there was a foul called on every single possession? Do you remember the beginning of 2 years ago where there was like literally like a 10-minute stretch where the Huskies had a foul called them on them on defense every single possession?
I can't say I remember that specifically.
No. It was like Thanksgiving 2 years ago.
Oh, you're talking about, yeah. I guess
we were watching opposite the 49ers game, Seahawks 49ers. So that was 3 years ago?
Yeah, I'm not sure anymore.
Anyway, there haven't been as many fouls called.
Yeah,
it's something. It's definitely something.
The Huskies rank 307th in free throw attempts per field goal attempt for opponents. So that's not been great either. But they've been pretty good at defensive rebounding, and they forced a decent number of turnovers.
There we go.
Those are the positives. So Huskies back home this weekend, where they will take on Seattle U and UC Davis in a pair of games they should win. It would be a little troubling if they didn't win both of those games. Seattle U off to a 2-3 start. They also, because they were involved in the campus part of the 2K Classic, they have also faced Belmont, who the Huskies beat in their opener, lost by 13 at Belmont. They faced St. Louis, who was also part of that 2K Classic, and lost at St. Louis by 16, and then lost also by 16 at Wazoo. And their two wins have come over non-D1 UPS, and then Detroit, which is ranked number 298th in the country.
Okay.
So they're you know, Huskies should comfortably beat them in that inner-city rivalry. So this isn't really UW news, but certainly seemed relevant to discuss. News broke Tuesday that Missouri freshman Michael Porter Jr., the former UW recruit, the apple of our eyes last year, has undergone back surgery after dealing with an injury that felled him, I think, 2 minutes into Missouri's first game, or at least sidelined him starting then. And it is expected that it will keep him out the remainder of the college season.
And probably his entire college tenure.
Yeah, so he will probably play 2 minutes in his college career.
Man, insane.
That's really sad to say. I mean, I was so excited about Michael Porter Jr., even at Missouri.
We'll see Michael Porter Jr. next year.
Yes. Yes, we will.
He was clearly an NBA-ready player in high school. I'm a little bit sad that we don't get to see him in college. I mean, I don't have ill will toward Missouri, but whatever.
It's the one weird thing is we won't get to like see what the Huskies season would have been like.
Yes.
No, Although we will get to see what the Huskies season would have been like. I mean, I guess if you were one of those people that were making the case that one recruit isn't worth like making your coaching decision based on, the fact that Michael Porter Jr. had surgery and is going to miss the entire season makes your case to some extent.
Yes. No, solid argument for those people.
Now,
there were other recruits in that class. Yeah,
Dejon Davis and Blake Harris also were part of that recruiting class. But, you know, a pretty good start for certainly Jalen Noel, and I think the UW freshmen have played credibly.
It is kind of nice, though, that we don't have to watch. Like, if Michael Porter Jr. was dominating college basketball this year and we had to watch that every single week, I think that would be rough.
That was my doomsday scenario. Women's basketball front, but the news better. Husky win bounced back from their opening loss with an 80-72 win over BYU in their second game. And then on Saturday, they traveled to face number 9 Ohio State over the weekend. And were very competitive in that, losing 85-76 in a game against one of the top 10 teams in the country. And then Kelsey Mitchell, who's one of the leading scorers in the country. So the UW women up to 77th by the Sagarin Predictor, which I think is better than we would have expected for the season, given everyone they had lost from last year. The schedule does not get a lot easier this weekend. They travel to Las Vegas to play in the South Point Shootout against Creighton and number 2 Texas. So tough early schedule for Jody Wynn and the Husky women. All right, now should we talk about celebrate the Sounders?
Here we go. It feels weird toasting this Blazers beer to this to the Sounders. Yeah.
People in Portland love the Sounders. A 2-0 win.
Really?
On the road in Houston.
Let's just say Portland did us a favor here.
They did, yes. Very much.
Thank you, Portland.
This was a game that Houston really never seemed particularly competitive in. Sounders get the early goal from Gustav Svensson off a corner kick.
It's a weird game. It didn't really feel like a playoff game.
No, I don't think it did. And then foul on Jahlil Anibaba, the former Sounder defender, in the box leads to a penalty, which Houston was able to save. Nicola Ladero was stopped on that one, but also Anibaba red-carded, reduces Houston to 10 players, and that made it difficult for them to really slow down the Sounders' attack or mount any attack of their own. Sounders get a second goal later in the first half from Will Bruin playing against his former team.
Thrill Bruin. I mean, a lot of connections between Houston and Seattle. Surprisingly, they have Dylan Remick also.
Yeah, who also came in this match as a reserve. Will Bruin, what an amazing pickup.
Yes.
Like, he's coming huge with Jordan Morris sidelined for the last couple months here, and there is some talk that Morris might be able to get back for the second leg of this match next Thursday, the home leg.
Okay, so why would you push it?
I don't know that you would push it.
To get him time. Like, honestly, like, what would be an argument? Let's say that he's 90%. Is it worth it to get him on the field to kind of get him in-game action before what is most likely going to be the MLS Cup?
I mean, I think particularly if you brought him on as a sub for like the last 20 minutes or so, you know, if you were comfortably ahead in that situation, I think that might be a nice way to ease him in ahead of a potential MLS Cup.
Okay. I thought it was interesting that they took out Dempsey so early. He came out at the half, right?
He did. Yeah, and they said he had taken a knock on the outside of a knee, but then also able to keep him very fresh going into that match. You'll have 9 days off between them. Really an ideal situation for the Sounders, except for one thing.
Okay.
That Roman Torres picked up a yellow card late in this match, was really playing up to the edge, daring the referee to give him a yellow card.
He was really Roman Torres-ing it.
And now he'll be out on yellow card suspension for the second leg of this match. So the Sounders will have to start someone else, maybe Tony Alfaro, maybe they, you know, move someone else back to defensive midfield and play Gustav Svensson there, but we'll see exactly what they do.
But so what would you say are the percentage chances of the Sounders to advance to the finals?
You know, I never got circled back to look it up on 538, which said that they were 51% favorites before they got this game. So besides for the fact
61% favorites.
Yeah. Besides for the fact that they got, you know, they lead by 2 goals, they also get the 2 road goals, which is the tiebreaker. Yes. So Houston has to either win by 3 goals or score at like, if they'd have to score twice, you know, they have to win 2-0 to force extra time. That's the only scenario.
Otherwise, if the Sounders score a goal, Houston all of a sudden needs to score 4 goals.
I mean, yeah, that's an insane number.
Yes.
Like, it's really an advantageous shit. 97% is what 538 says. So the Sounders now given a 37% chance to win MLS Cup, almost equal to Toronto FC's 43% chance, despite the fact that Toronto FC is much higher rated in the Soccer Power Index.
Wait, what do you mean by that? Almost as high as their 43% chance?
Yeah, I mean, Toronto FC is still the favorite to win the MLS Cup.
Oh, okay.
But it's almost even because of the fact that Toronto, which drew nil-nil without
Sebastian. They still need to get there.
Yeah, they still had Sebastian Giovinco and Jozy Altidore were both suspended for this match for various card accumulations. So they are still on a bit of a knife edge as they prepare for their home leg. So an enviable situation for this. We haven't mentioned that they did this all without Stephen Fry.
Yes, Tyler Miller looking good.
He was very effective in goal.
I wouldn't say he was necessarily challenged all that much, but...
No, but came off his line a couple of times to make plays. You know, for someone who hasn't had a lot of experience in a setting like this, a tremendous performance by him.
So Stephen Fry, we just found out that he's not playing today.
When the lineup came out, that was the first time we knew about
this.
He picked up a hamstring injury on training, which it's kind of amazing. There was this 3-week stretch where the Sounders didn't play. It was 19 days between games. And somehow not only did the Sounders not get Jordan Morris or Osvaldo Alonso, who doesn't appear that he'll be able to play in the conference finals at all, didn't get either of those guys back. They also got an additional injury. I don't know how that happened.
I'll tell you what, not a long enough break.
Yeah, they should have had a longer break.
Should have been 2 to 3 weeks longer.
That's absolutely true. So there was a bit of news over the break.
Oh, really?
So Clint Dempsey was named MLS Comeback Player of the Year for his successful return after missing the end of last year, including the MLS Cup run due to, you know, I guess undisclosed issues that we believe related to an irregular heartbeat. ESPN also reported after that he has extended his contract through 2018. So
all right.
I'll toast to having Dempsey around another season.
A toast to Clint.
Yeah. I mean, he remains an indispensable part of the
team. Can you imagine if this was the Seahawks and they were right on the precipice of going to the Super Bowl? If they had a 97% chance of going to the Super Bowl, how excited we'd be?
I'm trying to think if there was a scenario.
Soccer's not great at building drama in a lot of ways.
Oh, because there was a 3-week break between games?
Not even just that. It's just like the way that this is set up with the home and home is like, all right.
The one cool thing is, so the Sounders... You know,
they get to play for a 0-0 draw at home.
Well, last year when they won the Western Conference, it was on the road because they were the lower seed. So they have not ever won anything since, other than the U.S. Open Cup. They've not won any MLS like playoff competition, like major playoff, either win the West or win the MLS Cup. They've never done that at home. So this is an opportunity for them to do it at home for the first time next Thursday.
Okay, so let's say that the Sounders do advance. Hypothetically speaking, I mean, there's a 97% chance.
That's
a pretty good shot. Well, I'll knock on wood.
I mean, Utah had a 97% chance of winning on Saturday.
Does it matter? I mean, obviously Toronto is the better team, but do the Sounders travel to either of those squads?
Yes, they cannot host the MLS Cup.
Okay. Because it goes strictly to points after that?
Yes, and the Eastern Conference teams, even Columbus, which was, I believe, either the last or second to last team in the East, still better on points than the Sounders.
Mm-hmm. We're like the Buffalo Bills over here. We're just squeaking by.
I wouldn't necessarily go with that comparison. I don't remember the Bills winning the Super Bowl last year.
Okay, fine. Yeah. I guess we're the Patriots.
Let's go with us being like the Cavs being the second seed in the East last year.
Okay.
Can we go with that?
All right. Well, still pretty amazing, though.
Yeah. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, people should be more excited about the Sounders, given, you know, where they are right now. Like, this is a good time to rally behind the team and get excited about the chance to win something really important at home is pretty cool. So I mentioned Saturday in Utah. I said 97%. I think I'd have to double check this, but their win probability, I think at one point, got over 99% in that game as they led the Huskies by multiple scores in the fourth quarter of that game. Wow. The Huskies came back not only to win the game, but to win it somehow in regulation time with a field goal from Tristan Vizcaíno. Off to malign Tristan Vizcaíno.
Believed in him all year.
I've always said it.
You know what I say? You just want to get him a lot of kicks to build up the confidence.
Yeah, and sometimes some missed kicks in this game. There was a missed extra point and a missed field goal earlier, but he made the most important one. Which came at is regulation ended. So this was a weird game. Utah, a team that had not previously been very effective offensively, put up 30 points. Tyler Huntley, their quarterback, threw for 293 yards, 10.9 yards per attempt. How concerned should we be about this fact?
I think we should be pretty concerned. I mean, this is a couple weeks in a row where Stanford did kind of beat the Huskies on the ground, but... What got them into the position to be able to beat the Huskies on the ground was their passing game. Specifically hitting these receivers like Arcega-Whiteside, yes. Who have not been that great of receivers all season. And then against the Huskies, they look pretty darn good. And it's kind of the same with Utah, where it's like, we always felt like no matter what happens, Coach Pete is going to be able to coach the secondary. He's going to have these corners ready. And this was the first week where we looked at it and said, this is a very injured secondary.
Which was less injured last week because the Huskies did get Byron Murphy back for the first time in conference play. By the way, I wouldn't say that KJ Costello was necessarily great against Cal as Stanford wrapped up the Pac-12, or at least eliminated the Huskies from the Pac-12 North, I should say.
Yes.
Last week, he was 17 of 26 for 185 yards against Cal.
All of a sudden, Stanford is Husky fans. But
yep,
the secondary looks vulnerable. The thing to me, though, is this weekend, on paper, people feel like they're facing this amazing Wazoo passing attack. But actually, it's an amazing Wazoo defense and a kind of average passing attack.
So I think both of these teams are in some ways misunderstood because the Huskies' defense has gotten a lot of credit all year and people have really gotten on the offense. There's been talk that Jake Browning won't be the starting quarterback next year, which is
who is that talk from?
Insane.
I want to air a grievance.
The dark corners of the internet.
Whomever that was. It was Softy instigating it, wasn't it?
Softy had the poll about it, but I assume it was because of the fact that he was hearing from crazy Husky fans previously. That was what precipitated the poll. So here's the thing that's remarkable in this context.
We should trade Jimmy Graham too.
Yes. The Huskies rank better in FPI efficiency on ESPN in offense than any of the other phases of the game. They are 13th in offense, 15th in defense after last week, and 41st in special teams, which is the other factor, by the way, that really propelled Utah in this game. They dominated the Huskies on special teams in this way.
Well, and also playing like a David game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was impressed with Utah. That's the thing. I always like it when teams really try.
Well, did you note that Utah fans were furious at Kyle Whittingham after the game?
What?
Yeah, because
Because
of the timeout he took. Specifically,
I don't even remember this.
So when the Huskies got the ball back in the waning seconds, first down they had a run for maybe 2 yards.
Oh, and he took a timeout.
He took a timeout, and then the Huskies went down the field and scored.
And they were furious about that.
Yeah, which is
the Utah was only in this game because of Kyle Whittingham being aggressive.
I would agree with that. I know I in the stands, standing next to you, was terrified that the Huskies were somehow going to turn the ball over at that
point. Oh, yeah.
I was hoping for a QB kneel.
There's some of those situations where it's like the other team does something and you're like, please do that.
Right.
Where like you look at your own offense and so the defense is taking a timeout and you're like, take a timeout. We're coming down and scoring. This was not one of those situations.
Absolutely not. Nothing about the way the game had unfolded suggested that was going to play out.
I mean, honestly, if you would have told any of us before this game that Tristan Vizcaino is going to need to run out on the field and kick a field goal without the like clock even being stopped, and he was going to hit it to win the game?
Wait, was that the case?
I think so. We probably would not have assumed that that field goal was going in.
No. I mean, I had predicted to you and the famous cousin Katie before the drive where the Huskies tied it, I thought that the Huskies were going to score a touchdown and miss the extra point.
Yeah. No.
Much like they did against BYU and Jake Locker, the 0-12 year under Tyrone Willingham.
Still would have won by 2, though. Wouldn't have mattered this game.
I think things might have played out very differently in that scenario.
Oh, well, I completely disagree with those Utah fans. Anyway.
No, there was an incomplete pass before that.
He's still having to run out. There's not a timeout.
All right, fair.
Anyway, it feels like these are kind of misunderstood teams based upon their reputations or whatever.
All right, so we talked about the Huskies. And the other thing I think that's misunderstood is, quite frankly, the Cougs aren't as good as people think they are. Like, I hesitate to say that before this week. I don't think it guarantees the Huskies a victory because I have significant concerns about the Huskies' defense at this point. But, you know, Wazoo is ranked ahead of the Huskies in every poll because of the fact that they have the same record and the Cougs have better wins, have beat USC and beat Stanford, who the Huskies lost to.
Who they faced both at home.
They did. And despite that, the Huskies are ranked 7th still in FPI, and the Cougars are ranked lower than 7th. Substantially lower than 7th, as a matter of fact. They are ranked, let me scroll down here, scrolling, they're ranked 29th.
Wow!
Not a top 25 team by FBI. So why, you might ask, given these two teams have the same record and the Cougars have played the more difficult schedule, why are the Huskies so much higher rated, you might ask? And the answer is that, so if you look at conference play,
we'll
take out the fact that the Cougars' non-conference schedule was not, you know, tremendously difficult. In conference play, where both teams have gone 6-2, the Huskies have outscored opponents by 242 points. The Cougars have outscored opponents by 111 points. They have more than double their point differential. And as we know, that's the better predictor of team success going forward than the team's record. So now let's talk about, as you mentioned, the alluded to, the disconnect on offense and defense. The Cougar offense, so highly rated, Luke Falk, like setting every Pac-12 record as a quarterback, 67th in the country in offense. Lower ranked than Colorado.
Wow.
Substantially. Colorado, I believe, is 54th. Whereas the defense ranks 6th in the country, better than the Huskies' defense, which has gotten a lot more credit. And so you look at it, on a per-play basis, UW has been way better offensively than the Cougars. They average 8.5 yards per pass to the Cougars, 6.8, and 4.9 yards per run to the Cougars, 3.1, and they have half as many turnovers per 100 plays. So why do people think the Cougars' offense is so good? Well, the answer is they run 81 plays per game. Yes. The Huskies run 64. You basically have to multiply the Huskies' scoring stats, and they still score more points than per game. You have to multiply them by a quarter to get them equivalent to the Cougars, if you were, you know, like a per 100 plays, if we're talking about it in like a basketball sense. But on the other side, the Cougars actually are allowing more yards per play in both on through the air and on the ground than the Huskies. What really has carried their defense, despite the fact, in addition to the fact that they've faced a stronger set of offenses than the Huskies have, the Huskies have faced a weirdly bad set of offenses and a much better set of defenses, but they're forcing 3.9 turnovers per 100 plays, which is incredible, to UW's 2.3. So this is a really good defense and is going to be a tough nut for the Huskies offense to crack.
I'll accept that.
The other thing, by the way, the Cougars don't do well, special teams. They rank 120th in the country in FPI efficiency.
Who is their defensive coordinator? Like, how did Mike Leach manage to make this team with this reputation? Is it just because of the total amount of plays?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the idea that, you know, he's a... I mean, again, all these records that Luke Falk is setting, even though he's occasionally been benched. and probably rightly so. And then Mike Leach's reputation is an offensive innovator and the success... I mean, his Texas Tech teams were legitimately outstanding offensively. And some of his Cougar teams have been, too. This one just isn't. Alex Grinch is the defensive coordinator who's really led this turnaround. He's in his third season.
He's good.
Yeah. And they've got a playmaking defense.
I mean, it's been happening year after year after year that they've been becoming a better defense.
Yeah.
And it's kind of culminated in this one. And I feel like the defense is... Still, they get some recognition, but not the kind of recognition that they deserve.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, however, in this one, I'm not going to say that the Huskies are going to score a ton of points, but I feel like this offense is going to move the ball in this game. Myles Gaskin has looked really good lately. If they can get Jake into pretty good situations, which a lot of times he looked pretty comfortable against Utah, I think the Huskies are going to score on this Wazoo defense, and they're going to score enough to make this a comfortable victory.
A comfortable victory? Huh. I mean, it's an interesting case of strength against strength because, you know, as I mentioned, the Huskies very good at taking care of the football, have generally avoided turnovers all season. They've, you know, they're third lowest in turnovers per game in the Pac-12. And you're going up against this Washington State defense that has really relied, in many cases, on forcing turnovers, has thrived with them. And that's part of, I think that's also part of, by the way, why the offense looks so good, is they keep getting set up in good field position by these turnovers forced by the defense, despite the fact that the defense is often getting put in hard positions by the offense turning the ball over. So that's another case where it's sort of misleading the way that player teams are. If the Huskies can avoid turnovers, though, yeah, I mean, I think they can be successful probably on the ground and move the ball, if not with big plays, at least consistently.
I like the ground game in this one. And really, just what Myles Gaskin has been doing this season, he is so good. You know, they didn't really get Ahmed involved as much as we would have liked to have seen him involved last week, but just him being on the field opens things up so much.
Absolutely.
And I just don't see Wazoo having an answer for him. I mean, I look at everything about this game, and nothing about it suggests to me that Wazoo should win. Nothing about it even necessarily suggests to me that it should be a close game.
Which, by the way, it's a 10-point line. So Vegas is always, Vegas knows what's really up.
It's a 10-point line.
That's what it was when I looked this up earlier this week. It may have gone down a little bit since then. But
if you would ask me what the line was, I would have guessed 6.5.
You would have lost to Cousin Sal and Bill Simmons on that one, I think.
I'm honestly a little bit surprised how confident Vegas is in the Huskies, because it feels like pollsters everywhere do not believe in this team.
Yeah. I mean, again, we've talked about this before. What's the Huskies' best win this season?
It's coming. This it's coming on Saturday.
If they beat the Cougars, that would undoubtedly be their best win.
Do we think, I want to do percentage chances of victory in a second. Do we think that there's almost any chance of them reaching one of the New Year's Six games at this point? Today's rankings, they came out still at number 18.
I think they moved up. I thought they moved up one spot to 17.
Okay, great.
But maybe they did.
It's going to take quite a bit of attrition ahead of them, though.
But they're also, I mean, they also, I think, again, like they would look so much, their resume looks totally different if they win this game, because now all of a sudden they have a much more impressive win than they currently have.
And where does Wazoo rank in the traditional polls? Like
the Cougs are 15th in the coaches poll and 14th in the AP, the Huskies vice versa.
What about the college football playoff?
In the college football playoff, the Cougars are 13th and the Huskies are 17th.
13th? They're saying, like, so, okay, if Wazoo is 13th, you're basically saying to me that if Wazoo wins this game, they're almost guaranteed, they would win the Pac-12, right?
They would win the North,
yeah. The Pac-12 North. Yes. They would be almost guaranteed, depending on what happened in the Pac-12 championship, of being in one of those New Year's Six games.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Because they would get destroyed by USC.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I think that USC would be favored on a neutral field, but I don't think it would be a lopsided game.
Okay, so I feel much better about this, actually.
About the chances of getting a New Year's Six Bowl?
Yeah!
Yeah, I mean, it's a realistic possibility. Now, again, depending on where Central Florida is the best of the group of five schools, the Huskies would probably have...
We're cheering for them over USF.
Yeah, I guess so. Has to be in, so it doesn't really matter who. I'm more worried about this game than you are, because I do think the secondary is a concern. If you look at it, the Huskies have only allowed 200 yards passing three times this year. One of those was against Arizona State in a game where Arizona State passed the ball, one of their losses, but a game where Arizona State passed the ball 41 times to get up to 245 yards. The other two coming 211 2 weeks ago against Stanford, 293 last week against Utah. This is like way out of line for the Huskies. And while this Cougar passing attack may be overrated, it's still capable of taking advantage, exploiting holes in the UW secondary repeatedly. So I don't know. I'm nervous about this one. And it's the Apple Cup.
What is your percentage chance of victory?
Like 60? Where are you at?
75.
Wow.
I mean,
that is a Tristan wow from me.
My chances of victory are lower than the FPI win probability in this game. You're talking about a very good Husky team who had a couple of tough losses on the road and kind of one anomaly game against Utah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm overreacting to the game against Utah. I'm certainly open to that possibility. Maybe it was just Pac-12 after dark and
shit happens.
I shouldn't read that much into it. But I mean, again, I'm nervous.
Okay. Sure. Be nervous. But this is not going to be a close game.
The thing that's interesting, and this has been the case for several years in a row, Cougar fans are so confident about this.
Every year!
So confident. Maybe this is the year. Maybe they celebrate winning the Pac-12 North at Husky
Stadium. They're like Husky fans when we lost to Oregon like 18 straight times. Every year we were confident.
I was not confident. I don't remember being confident any of those years.
All of the years they had Mariota. He played for like 9 years.
Something like that.
Yeah, Cougar fans are very confident, so good for them.
Yeah, we'll check back on that next week. All right, I think it's time.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Okay, I'm sure after Monday night, we've got some grievances here. Actually, I kind of want to air a grievance about Saturday. You're constantly talking about how much you want to play exciting close games and not blowouts.
Your grievances with me?
My grievance is I did not enjoy the fact that was a close, exciting game. No.
Are you kidding me?
I didn't need that. I would have been happy to have had the Huskies win by multiple touchdowns and be like headed home at 10:30 at a somewhat reasonable hour from the 7:30 start.
I'm sorry, but that was the most fun Husky game that we've been at in like 3 years.
There was a lot of angst to get there. And the other thing
that's what sports is about. This is why we pay attention. We love the angst. Winning is fun.
You didn't seem to love it last night. Because the other thing about close games is sometimes you play them and sometimes the kicker misses that kick.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes up short from 52 yards. Even though it seemed like it was dead on and it seemed like it was.
We still felt emotion though, did we not?
Yeah, I didn't need to feel that emotion. I barely slept last night.
You feel emotion. You barely slept last night because of it?
Like, I was just in such a foul mood. I mean, I fell asleep, but I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't get back to sleep.
Just stewing. Yeah, Pete throwing really the challenge flag. Running through your head.
Okay, I've got some grievances to air about that. Can we talk about that photo of Pete? Like, He looks really old in that photo where he's throwing the challenge flag. Also, how is he not, like, moving at all? Like, the flag is still moving, but he's not moving.
I want to talk before we get there. Before we get there, we've got a right. Like, these are not even grievances. This is more just like an angry conversation between us. But you're wrong. You're wrong. The reason we pay attention to sports is to feel feelings. We don't, like, there's not, you don't get anything if your team wins the championship. There's no monetary value, right?
I mean, sometimes you work for the team and you get a championship ring.
Yeah, pretty rarely.
Yeah, multiple times for me.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Throw you a fucking parade. Anyway.
they did.
You don't get, like, you go to the parade, but it's really, ultimately, winning is empty. I mean, I've talked about...
Not as empty as losing.
I've talked about this with you for so long that I've considered why we even pay attention to sports. And the reason you pay attention to sports is to feel feelings.
Yeah, you had a different... it was the same take, but it was a more excited spin on it after the Texans game.
Yeah! I mean, honestly, okay, so the reason I was... I'm going to start with the Utah game.
Okay.
It was an exciting game! We have not seen a close, exciting game at Husky Stadium since when? I mean, they lost to USC at home last year, but it wasn't really like a close loss.
I think they still had the possession with a chance to tie at the end of that, didn't they?
There might have been that, but this was an exciting game. It was fun seeing Vizcaino come out hit that field goal. It was great. Yeah. It was way better than all these blowout wins. I would take that game over the Oregon win 100 times out of 100.
I would not. I absolutely would not.
Talking about the Seahawks, this is an angle that I thought I was going, but you were just so wrong with your take that I had to push back on you. The reason that I was upset with that, I mean, okay, so the two reasons that I say that we care about sports are to feel feelings and watch games and feel the highs and lows of the games that you're watching, right?
Yeah.
But also is to extend the amount of time that you care about something.
That is true.
So, like, if the Seahawks...
Which, by the way, the MLS is doing a great job.
That's what they're about.
You know how long we've been... I didn't get the chance to get this in earlier, by the way. The previous time the Sounders had faced Houston before they played them in the conference championship was June.
2013.
You remember we played them in the season opener? That was 8 months ago. That's so long ago. That's like two-thirds of your child's life.
We were younger then.
Your youngest child's life has occurred since the Sounders started the season.
I've seen some things since that happened.
Well, we have seen some things. Anyway,
the other thing is to prolong how long you care about something. If your team is eliminated from playoff contention or whatever in like after the first month, it's boring and it sucks. That's why it's bad. You want to be in it for as long as possible. That's why going to the Super Bowl is fun, because you get those 2 weeks to care. You get the entire season to care from day one to the last day of the season.
It's why going to the Sweet 16 is more fun than... It's like a greater multiple or fun than just winning the first round of the NCAA tournament.
As Husky fans, we only understand going to the Sweet 16. So it probably is true for going to the Final Four also, but we're just not aware of those feelings.
Hey, women's team got there. Anyway, shouts to Kelsey Plum.
That's why that game sucked, just because it felt like, and you know, statistically with their playoff odds, this also played out. It felt like the amount that we are going to care lengthwise about the season was reduced.
Yeah.
But when Blair Walsh missed that field goal, it just sucked because it was a fun game to watch. The comeback was exciting. We were cheering. The crowd was louder than I've ever seen it.
So you weren't complaining about the crowd?
No, the crowd was great. The crowd was excellent for that game. It's Monday night. People are going to be turned up, you know?
No. Turned up or just turned up?
Turned up. But it felt like when Blair Walsh missed that field goal, like we were robbed of more game action.
I mean, would you have been unhappy if the Seahawks had been down 2 and that kick had been to win? Like,
no, that would have been exciting too. But I just wanted to see more game at that point. And he missed it. And it was like, we have to go home now?
Yeah.
To our awful lives?
I was like, I have to go pick you up now?
To our terrible jobs booking rock concerts?
To our terrible jobs writing about the NBA?
I was going to go with a grievance about Pete Carroll and his terrible decisions, but I like this better. This is not even a grievance.
I mean, are we going to talk about Pete Carroll's terrible decisions? What are we going to defend? Am I going to get the chance to defend one of Pete Carroll's terrible decisions? Shouts to Ben B.
I feel like I've been like beaten into thinking this was a good decision.
Okay, good. I'm glad. We're going to get the fake field goal here.
I mean, I still would have liked those points. I don't know.
Here's my one remaining take. I think they should have saved that play for a subsequent field goal attempt when they could have gotten some value out of just making a first down when it wasn't touchdown or bust.
Yes. Because if you get the first down, the expected points added, if you just get the first down, you're still kicking a field goal.
And because of the chance that the half could have run out entirely
without
Luke Wilson scoring on that play. I mean, they did kick a goal in the second half, didn't they? Like, there would have been an opportunity to run that play again.
Obviously not after the first time.
No, but I mean, I'm saying if you had saved that play, which clearly was based on something they'd seen from the Falcons, had confirmed, seen it on tape, and then confirmed it with their alignment in the first field goal that they attempted and made in the game. And then subsequently, Atlanta stunted at the line such that that blew up the play.
Yes.
There was one way they could have defended the play that would have prevented it from going to a touchdown, and they did it.
Yes. I'm not against the idea of that fake field goal. I just felt like the situation was the wrong situation to employ the fake field goal.
I agree with that.
That's it.
We're on the same page on that.
But the bigger issues were not that. The bigger issue is the challenge on the Doug Baldwin non-catch.
Yep.
I couldn't see it, but like it was not a catch. Sometimes a catch. You can tell Doug Baldwin it's not a catch.
Even you who tried to argue that Paul Richardson play in the playoff game last year.
Still a catch, not but a okay. Catch. the Paul Richardson play was much more of a catch than this Doug Baldwin was a catch.
That is accurate. And then also wasting a timeout on 3rd and 12 early in the second half. Like,
what? Who called that?
I mean,
I think Russell Wilson called
that at the line, but
at some point you need to be like, hey, Russ, don't blow timeouts in the second half. If it's the first half, whatever.
And it depends on the situation. If it's like 3rd and 3, if it's a 3rd and short situation, then maybe, yeah, you take that timeout. But 3rd and 12, the difference between 3rd and 12 and 3rd and 17 is not useful enough to waste that timeout.
To me, the most inexcusable play, though, was the play before that Doug Baldwin non-catch. And that's Eddie Lacy on 2nd and 2, just running into the line of scrimmage. I saw a tweet where I wish that I could credit this person, where they're like, instead of running Eddie Lacy, they should just tell the line judge to flip the play. It's like, yeah. The only thing that could happen is they might go backwards. The CX need to release Eddie Lacy so they're not tempted to run him.
I still think it's less about Eddie Lacy than whatever.
I'm sorry, but like you can only blame. Here's the thing.
I mean, first off, everyone is excited about Mike Davis was, and the screen passes. Incredible to see a CX.
We're not running screen passes to Eddie Lacy.
But he still did average. He had 13 yards on one carry.
3 yards per carry is good for the Seahawks.
He had 13 yards on one carry. His other 5 carries went for 5 yards.
He had one carry was really blown up.
I mean, I just don't think that
But the way that Eddie Lacy is different than Mike Davis. Eddie Lacy.
The way they try to run with Eddie Lacy is different than the way they try to run with Mike Davis.
Sure. Whatever it is. Eddie Lacy and Thomas Rawls are not NFL running backs anymore. And yeah, Mike Davis, who you're pulling off your practice squad, is closer to it than they are.
Yep.
But we're paying Eddie Lacy $5 million.
J.D. McKissick played basically the entire second half. And he was
like
great.
J.D. McKissick.
So
great. Well, except for that one run that they had. But honestly, any time that they really ran it with McKissick, you're like, okay.
I mean, he did average 4.3 yards per carry, I think.
Yeah, the standards for a successful Seahawks run are very low. If they pick up 4 yards on first down, I'm like, this is huge.
I believe Bill Barnwell noted on Twitter today that they are currently on pace for the 10th lowest yards per carry in NFL history by a team's running backs, which is still better than the Arizona Cardinals this year. Shouts to Adrian Peterson.
Yeah, and their superstar running back is injured for the year. But also...
That is true.
Can we just...
So is Chris Carson.
Can we just have nice things for a second?
Yeah, can we? Is it too much to ask? Can someone stay healthy?
This is ridiculous. I mean, but shouts to Dwayne Brown for playing, though. Yes. And he looked good, right?
There was one play where he did not look particularly good, but for the most part, he did a good job. And I would not say that after his 6-sack game last week that we really saw a follow-up by Adrian Claiborne, who did, despite him scoring the touchdown on a fumble recovery.
Was he was the one who scored that touchdown?
Yeah, he recovered it, but he did not force that fumble, I don't think.
It's not like Ode Abushi is an amazing player, but also just every single game we have to have an offensive lineman who's injured.
Right.
The Rams have had the same starting offensive line every single game this year. How is that possible?
is that legal?
The Seahawks have had an offensive lineman injured in every single game this year. It's a stat that I just made up, and it's probably not true.
It is definitely not true. They've also
sometimes they're just bad.
I don't know if you've heard, they've had a lot of quarterbacks injured too. Shaquille Griffin going out.
Also, Shaq, how did that? I didn't even realize that happened because like I wasn't at my seat yet. I was ordering a Great State Burger while Shaq Griffin was getting that concussion.
Hashtag priorities.
Oh, Great State Burgers are undefeated.
No, they're not. The Seahawks lost the game. They're not undefeated.
Great State Burgers are undefeated. I saw somebody later with like maybe Kid Valley Burger, and I was just like, I was the most pretentious self I've ever been, seeing somebody with a Kid Valley Burger knowing that Great State was right there.
I'm disappointed you didn't tweet about it, because that would have been the most pretentious
thing. Just to pick a picture of them eating it with the like eyes to the side emoji. don't assume I didn't think about it. But I have a little bit of hope. There's a little bit of hope for this line. Do you share the same hope?
So your hope is that they get Luke Jokel back, they switch Ethan Posick to right guard, and then that's the group going forward?
That doesn't feel like that bad of an offensive line to me.
On paper, it's not. I mean,
Brown,
not a lot of continuity
in that
group.
Britt, Posick, and then also Jermaine Ifedi.
Jermaine Ifedi will be on the field.
Jermaine Ifedi was there too.
All right, should we talk about where the team stands?
That right there is where the team stands.
Is it? So, as you mentioned, a dramatic hit to their playoff chances by losing this game, down to 33%.
Wow.
Football Outsiders DVOA projections. I mean, we got to get comfortable with the idea that the Seahawks might not make the playoffs. You focused on me saying this 2 years ago, and then the Seahawks immediately winning all their games.
No, I think that was three years ago.
Well, I think it was I thought it was 2015 when...
There was a time that you said to me...
Oh, man, I guess you're right. It might have been 2014. It might have been the year they went to the Super Bowl.
Maybe it was 2015. You said to me, we have to face the very real possibility that the Seahawks are not going to make the playoffs. And it was chilling. And it's not as chilling now, because I'm facing the very real possibility that the Seahawks are not going to make the playoffs.
I mean, you just look at the injury situation, and it's bad. And then the other thing that's bad is the NFC is so good, where the Seahawks can be 6-4 record that would tie them for the top wild card spot in the AFC with the Tennessee Titans. And that leaves them tied for the in a three-way tie for the second wild card spot in the NFC with Detroit and Atlanta, who obviously now owns the tiebreaker. The Rams losing at Minnesota was good news. The Seahawks still, if they win out, they will definitively
control their own destiny.
Win the division. I want there to be like a replacement phrase for everybody who hates the phrase "control your own destiny," but there's not another phrase for it, like a more accurate.
It was giving me hope last night when I was up in the middle of the night.
That's
control their own destiny. I mean, control their own destiny. Control their own destiny.
So the interesting question,
Jared Goff coming here.
Interesting. Well, yeah. The interesting question is how much last night's game changed our assessment of the Seahawks. Because on the one hand, Atlanta converted 9 of 14 third downs. On the other hand, Atlanta converted 9 of 14 third downs. And much like three-pointers in basketball, third downs have outsized impact on the game, but tend to regress to the mean. On the other hand, the Seahawks secondary looked pretty bad when Atlanta tried to pick on Jeremy Lane and Byron Maxwell, who, by the way, Byron Maxwell, a yeoman's effort by him, given that he had been injured, was at home a week ago. Like, the fact that he was and then played, like, basically every snap after Shaq Griffin got hurt.
Are we expecting Shaq back versus the 49ers? I didn't even see him really come up during the injury conversation.
Yeah, I didn't see him either. I don't feel great about the chances.
Great.
I don't know.
Okay.
Now, as you've pointed out, the Seahawks did end up outgaining the Falcons on a yards per play basis in this game, 5.2 to 4.8. They moved the ball basically, I don't want to say at will, but they moved the ball consistently.
Almost every series they punted once.
Really, the difference in the game was primarily the two turnovers and the fact that they led to, you know, Atlanta scores one of them directly to a touchdown, one of them indirectly to a touchdown. And because of that, the Seahawks really didn't change at all in DVOA this week, which I think it has to be encouraging given that they were playing without as many guys as they were.
Yes.
So,
I mean, on paper, this seemed like a game where the Seahawks played quite badly, or at least certain facets of the Seahawks played quite badly.
By the way, how nice was it to see Tyler Lockett get going on kickoff return?
Oh, my God. I mean, he was more than get going.
Yeah, that was one of the best performances by a kickoff returner all season, I think.
Every single return.
That penalty on the punt return, not his fault. Oh, my
God.
I thought the grievances were over, but they're not.
I mean, that penalty cost them the game.
Also throwing underneath repeatedly on the final drive. Man, I mean, by the way, something that hasn't been mentioned, like the Seahawks only even had a chance to attempt a realistic field goal because of the fact that that Atlanta defender got hurt and stopped the clock.
Oh, yeah, that was nice.
That was such a huge save. Didn't end up mattering, but...
That's not necessarily the case, though. They might have thrown downfield more.
I suppose, but it would have been very difficult.
Okay, so what about San Francisco?
So the most interesting question about the 49ers right now, I think, is who's going to be at quarterback for them on Sunday. There was a report, I believe, from Adam Schefter before their most recent game against the Giants that they plan to start Jimmy Garoppolo this week after their bye. And now he's had a few weeks to get comfortable in the San Francisco offense, in the Kyle Shanahan offense. He stayed with the team during the bye week to work on the offense. But then against the Giants, C.J. Beathard went out and did C.J. Beathard things.
It's C.J. Beathard's team now.
He averaged 11.5 yards per attempt against the Giants, which was more than his previous two games combined. If you add his yards per attempt in both of those games, that only added up to 10.4. And he previously had completed fewer than 50% of his passes in both of those games, which meant they qualified as Stanton's callback. And then he went out against the Giants a couple weeks ago, who, granted, may not have the best defense in the NFL, although they were pretty
impressive last week.
And he completed, I think, like 75% of his pass in that game. So now it sounds like, reading between the lines, they have not announced a starter, but it sounds like it's going to be C.J. Beathard under center.
Wow.
Also, under center is a weird expression in 2017 because everyone plays the quarterback, shotgun all the time.
I am all for, I mean, granted, I wish it wasn't to the Patriots, but I am all for the 49ers trading a second round draft pick for a player that they won't play.
I mean, he may play at some point.
That.
You know, I don't know that C.J. Beathard will be as effective going forward as he was against the Giants. I will note about C.J. Beathard, though, you got to watch him on the ground. Deceptively athletic, C.J. Beathard. He ranks 7th in rushing DR among quarterbacks, despite only having started 4 games. So, besides that, Carlos Hyde is probably going to rip off a long run at some point in this game, and it's going to be frustrating.
Yep.
That's pretty much every single 49ers Seahawks game.
I'm more concerned about the C.J. Beathard run that he's going to pick up. We're going to have everything covered, and then he's just going to scramble for a first down.
Had 6 carries for 40 yards against Philadelphia, 5 carries for 30 yards against Dallas.
It is my least favorite play in all of football.
Those are also games they lost by a combined 53 points because the 49ers are not good. Like, they did have that stretch where they were very competitive and were losing a bunch of one-loss games, one-score games, I should say, until they lost by a combined 53 points to the Eagles and the Cowboys. Still, this team is very bad. They're 29th in offensive DVOA. They're 29th in defensive DVOA.
We're going to lose to C.J. Beathard.
If the Seahawks lose this game, the season is over. I will declare it.
This feels like the kind of game where Russ, I mean, they need to move the ball. We've said this over and over and over again. They did against Atlanta.
Yeah.
Right? This has to be a Russ game.
You know, weirdly, Russ did not have that good of a game.
I was expecting his stats to be better.
I know. They felt better. I think one thing that happened is there weren't any big plays in this game for the Seahawks. Their longest reception, I guess they had the Doug Baldwin touchdown. That was 29 yards. But before that, their longest play of the game was one of the Mike Davis screen passes, or the two Mike Davis screen passes for that matter, which went for 21 and 20 yards, respectively.
Still holding on hope that Mike Davis is back for the Mike Davis revenge game.
Oh, that would be great.
As is Mike Davis, because then otherwise, J.D. McKissick will be fine. I really like that the screen pass is part of the offense now.
Yep. It's a nice addition.
But it's hard to get a feel for this one because you know the 49ers are bad, but then also it was 12-9 here. You just don't really feel good about it.
Well, the question, I mean, it probably won't be raining in San Francisco.
That's something. It wasn't raining last night either.
It wasn't. I mean, it wasn't a bad performance by Ross other than that one inexplicable throw.
I do think it comes down to, does Joku play and how does this offensive line look? Because all of a sudden, I mean, if they hold up, and you've got Posick at right guard. You've got kind of a wall in front of Russ. Like what an offensive line might look like. Right. And it feels like, am I being too excited?
Settle down.
I've been saying this since before the Falcons game. I was hoping that they could just somehow, some way win that game. And then get Joku back. And maybe this will look like an offensive line again.
All right, I've got some bad news.
Oh, no.
I'm looking at the forecast for
it's going to rain?
Wednesday, sunshine. Thursday, sunshine. These are partly cloudy. Friday, partly cloudy. Saturday, partly cloudy. Monday, partly cloudy. Or Sunday, sunny. Tuesday, sunny. Wednesday, partly cloudy. Thursday, mostly sunny. The only day with any chance of pretty precipitation is Sunday.
I'm calling it right now.
Whoa, dude, were we talking about that? The idea of a rain cloud like just directly on Russell Wilson at all times?
Yes. It's okay. But this is going to be a Russell Wilson game. Russell Wilson is going to win this game.
I hope so, because I'm not playing against him in two different fantasy leagues this week. Like, added to the frustration just a little bit. Like, the fact that, like, look, if the Seahawks are going to lose, at least could I win the game where I'm playing two Falcons against two Seahawks?
Was the only complaint that I have about the crowd is people around us showing us their fantasy scores. It's like, I don't give a shit about your fantasy score right now. There is nothing I could care less about.
All right, on that note, chances of victory?
75%.
75? I'm much more pessimistic. I'm at 65% for this one.
I mean... Even statistically, the Seahawks are number 12 in DVOA overall.
Yes.
And still pretty balanced between offense, defense. Special teams looked really good this last week. And the 49ers are bad at everything.
They are bad at everything. Oh, by the way, I shortchanged them. They're 28th in offensive DVOA, not 29th. That's a big difference. And they're pretty good special teams. Pretty good special teams. So
there's that.
They got that going for them, which is nice.
But they're pretty bad at everything that they do. I mean... I'm sure that they would be very excited about beating the Seahawks, but also a win doesn't necessarily matter to the 49ers.
It matters to C.J. Beathard.
Ugh. C.J. Beathard's playing for his life out there. But I think...
just his job. I don't think his life.
No. Things are serious for C.J. Beathard.
Wow.
But I think Russ will have a good game. They'll work it around to a bunch of different receivers. I would like to see him over 300 yards in this one. Hopefully, maybe it doesn't even have to be. And I just don't want to see them run the ball with Thomas Rawls or Eddie Lacy, who seems like he's injured.
Okay, well, once again, we'd like to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. And after that, let's enjoy some football. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.